Welcome to the Linda News Hour, Monday morning. I'm delighted. I'm always delighted when Ellen Brown is on, and today is the day for Ellen to come on. Ellen is a civil litigation attorney. She's an author. She's a frequent writer on financial issues. Her latest book, and there's a brand new edition of it coming out next month. We will sure talk more about that. It's called Web of Death. It is an absolutely fabulous analysis of the private banking cartel Federal Reserve, how it usurped money creation power, and how we can take it back. And the Daily Bell. I can't forget the Daily Bell. It calls itself a compendium of free market thought. It awarded Ellen a title of her own. And it says there are now, in modern economic thought, Keynesians, Austrians, and Brownians. My goodness, I do love that. Ellen, welcome as always.
Steven, you do such a nice introduction.
I wish people gave me an introduction like that. Oh, they give me good introductions. They really do. Sometimes they absolutely floor me by the stuff when I hear it, Ellen, I turn around to see if they're talking about somebody else. Oh, your latest article is another gem. More on state banks with lots of examples, including the fact that not among the major candidates, but the idea of a state bank is catching on in state political races. Can I throw a couple of tidbits at you for all the more urgency to be doing this? I get daily reports from David Rosenberg. David used to be, I think, chief domestic economist at Merrill Lynch. He now works up in Canada for a small company called Gluskin Sheff, G-L-U-S-K-I-N, Sheff with two Fs, .net. And anybody can go to their website and sign up to get these same reports. They are terrific. I mean, every single day he puts out an extensive report. Last week, I think it was sometime, Ellen, he talked about the absolute horror story of contracting credit, and you sure written about that. And he quoted some recent numbers that that are at all-time highs, and I think one of his conclusions was based on so far what's happening in 2010. Credit contraction isn't slowing. It's increasing. It's increasing. And then today he makes the comment, how on earth can you have a recovery if credit is contracting? I mean, this has never happened before. Does anybody really believe that for the first time ever we could have contracting credit and a recovery? Well, you know, he's being sarcastic. We sure as hell cannot. Here's another gem, and I'll let you jump in. We may get close to the first break. This morning, he cites the Mortgage Bankers Association. He says, to little media attention, it released its fourth quarter data. It found that 15% of housing loans either were in foreclosure or behind in at least one quarterly payment in Q4 last year. That comes to 3.9 million Americans are more than 90 days behind in payments. And then he says, quote, which is triple the level of 2 years ago. Some recovery, Ellen, huh?
Wow. Yeah.
I mean, that's dramatic stuff. He comes up with this stuff all the time. It tells me that things aren't improving. They are getting worse. We need your prescription to the rescue, and right after the break, you jump in and talk about your latest article.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Get this terrible economic mess. We both know that. You sure have a way to fix it. Explain it again to listeners, especially your latest article.
Well, as you say, I've been hammering away at this for like a year and a half. That
a voice in the wilderness, huh?
That the states need to get their own credit machine. What's wrong right now is not that we're overspending. We don't need to tighten our belts. What's wrong is that we don't have credit out there. As you said, the loan market has collapsed. And so the fundamental thing that you have to understand that most people don't understand is that all of our money is debt. If we had no debt, we would have no money. So when loans disappear, when debt disappears, the money supply shrinks, and that means there's not enough money out there to buy goods and services, to pay employees, et cetera, and that is what's a recession and then a depression. And that's the cycle that we're in now. So we need to get more debt out there. I'm also working on an article right now that I'm almost finished with called IMF-style austerity measures comes to America. What fiscal responsibility will mean to you. The president just signed an executive order that would approve a committee that's going to look at how to balance the budget and get rid of some of this red ink. Well, getting rid of government red ink means shrinking the money supply even more. That's what they don't seem to understand. I mean, the president said he lays awake nights worrying about this red ink and what he's doing to his grandchildren, you know, that he's imposing this great debt on the grandchildren. But the debt is our money supply. We have a $12 trillion federal debt and something like a $13 or $14 trillion money supply. They're the same thing. So what you actually want to do is increase the debt. You don't want to cut the debt. And who is behind all this is Pete Peterson and his foundation. He will stand to profit handsomely if what he is proposing goes through. Part of their plan would be, of course, they'll slash services, raise taxes, the usual stuff, and cut Social Security. This is the Social Security we've already paid for. Like in the last 30 years, the baby boomers have overpaid every year on Social Security, and the whole idea was to have to put away some extra for because the baby boomers was going to be a bigger group than previously. So we did that, and we've got the money stocked away, and now they're talking about cutting back on that entitlement as if this is just something that we'll be gouging the public for, but we've actually paid that money. So that's one thing. But worse yet, they're talking about a mandatory savings tax. The idea is that we can't save on our own. You know, we're such big spenders that we, the people, don't know how to save, and so they're going to help us save by taking yet more money out of our paychecks. But that doesn't mean that we're going to get more in Social Security. We're going to get less. I mean, they're talking about putting the Social Security age, the retirement age, off. So what's going to happen to this money that they're taking out of our paychecks? It's going to go into a fund, which will be managed, a fund that will invest this money. Well, who's going to manage it? It turns out it's a spinoff of Pete Peterson's company. and it's mandatory. I mean, you know, it's mandatory. What a great cash cow.
Only in America, Ellen.
Yeah. But then the state idea, in North Dakota, the only state that right now is fiscally sound. A year ago, there were four states who were able to meet their budgets, and then there were three, and then there were two, and now there's one. North Dakota is the only state. Montana was the second, and they will manage to meet their budget, but they're going to have to do it by slashing services. And North Dakota still has a surplus. They don't have to slash anything. And what does North Dakota have that distinguishes it? The only thing it has is its own state-owned bank. They do have some oil, but there are oil states like Oklahoma that are really suffering because the price of oil dropped. So what North Dakota does is generate its own credit. It acts like the Bank of North Dakota acts like any bank, creating credit on its books. Some people argue, well, if you have state banks, they're going to be competing with the community banks, and that would be bad for the community banks, and they don't want more competition. But they won't be. That's the thing. They'll be adding credit. They're not going to be fighting the other banks for deposits. They're going to be creating deposits because that's the way banking works. Loans create deposits. It's a maxim of, you know, economics. It's not the other way around. It's not that they lend your deposits. They make the loan, and that becomes a deposit. And then when that money leaves the bank, like if the borrower writes a check on the account, then the bank has to cover it, but they're not covering that actual money. All they just have to have money coming into the bank equal to the money that goes out. So if they don't have it in the way of deposits, they borrow it from the interbank lending market. So basically, they just borrowed that money that they created back. Say if you make a $1,000 loan, and then there's a check written on that account, and the money goes into Bank B. Well, Bank B now has $1,000 of excess reserves that they don't need, and they want to make a little interest on it. So they put it, make it available in the interbank lending market. So Bank A can borrow back the money it just created at a very low interest rate, and then it's charging a higher interest rate on what it to its customer. So that's how it makes its money on that spread. But the point is that the banks are creating the money they lend, and so our new state bank, but they're frozen right now. They can't really do much for various reasons. They can't or they won't. But our state bank then will have a huge deposit base, a huge asset base, because they can use the revenues and the assets of the state. In North Dakota, it's called North Dakota Doing Business as the Bank of North Dakota. So it's a DBA. So all the assets of the state are the assets of the bank. So here you have this huge credit mechanism that can be generating credit for all sorts of things that the state needs, like transportation and alternative energy and things that will put people back to work. You're just creating the credit to create the thing that will generate the profits that will pay back the loan. So instead of thinking you have to find the money first, and we can't do anything because we can't find any money to do it, you create the money. You create it as credit, and what it is basically little receipts that are going to pay off the workers and materials that are building the thing you need that will pay back the loan.
Ellen, everything you're saying, and you know I support your prescription, it's a prescription that works. I guess that's the reason nobody is touching it with a 10-foot pole. They prefer ones that don't work. That does not mean that the privately owned Federal Reserve could not do the same thing. It could literally serve the people and not these giant banks. But of course, that's not what it does. It functions to make profits for its shareholders, the major banks, mainly the big ones on Wall Street. So it really is an anti-people bank, an anti-people operation. And I've mentioned several times in some of my articles, and I absolutely believe this is true because it's happened before, that the economic crisis we're in right now broke in the fall of 2007 and really accelerated throughout 2008 into early 2009. I don't think this happened by chance. I think it was designed to happen, and I think there is a round two coming ahead that very possibly, and I honest to God believe, will be a lot worse than round one. They want this to happen, which seems like an act of insanity, but it's not, because the scheme works. It happened in East Asia in 1997, 1998, also Russia and parts of Latin America. The idea is to create this economic calamity, get assets to plunge in value, then give these people, the giants who caused this problem, a wonderful chance to eliminate competition and buy up other pieces of shattered operations at a fraction of their higher prices. So it's a wonderful way to make a foolproof investment. Send the elevator crashing to the sub-basement, and then get it fixed and ride it up to the top again, and then crash it again. And they've come a long way. I mean, look at the consolidation in the past couple of years, Ellen. And maybe they want to do more. There may be some more that are targeted to be eliminated. I mean, if we go back a couple of years, it's shocking to think of such venerable names that no longer exist. Merrill Lynch and Lehman and Bear Stearns. I mean, these companies were around forever, and they don't exist anymore. Bear is part of Chase, and Merrill is part of Bank of America. But I mean, just think of the bigger banks, and don't think of these former companies that basically are gone. And you wrote an article suggesting that, my goodness, was Lehman pushed? Well, I can only say it sure as hell was pushed.
Mm-hmm.
It sure as hell was, and I think there's a lot more pushing to come. Who can tell? But I think there's a lot more pushing. But the main pushing is against us. And this scheme about, my God, mandatory IRAs and other retirement accounts. My God, how do these people get away with these ideas? I mean, will the public really go along with this and not literally be incited to the point of rebellion? I don't know why.
That was the catch on that whole. I'll tell you after the break.
This is just an idea at this point, right, Ellen?
No, that executive order has been signed. It was signed last Thursday, and the plan was, I hear your music, so I'll tell you.
Yeah, we got to take a break. Explain the order when we come back.
Right.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Brown. Ellen, I think what I was really asking, the executive order is signed. Does it really authorize a firm go ahead on this? This is the way it's going to be, and it will proceed accordingly. Is that where we are right now?
The bills that were turned down by Congress would have appointed this committee that would then have the power to make all these budget decisions on its own. You know, in the Constitution, it's Congress that has the power to determine the budget, nobody else. But this committee would do it, and obviously it would be loaded with Pete Peterson's people. And then it was supposed to go to Congress for an up or down vote. That was it. No discussion. It's just yay or nay. And this would be in a lame duck Congress after the election. So you could easily see this... see them being taken in by the rhetoric that, well, we have to do something about this horrible debt, and you're in the lame duck Congress. What do you care? I mean, you might as well make the hard decisions for the people, because we need that, you know, and nobody else is going to want to do it. You could see them being taken in by that argument, because nobody understands, most people don't understand that our money is debt, and that the debt is a good thing, and that we should not try to cut the debt at a time when we already have a shrinking money supply. If you cut the debt, you cut the money. And one man's debt is another man's savings or another man's money. So the way it stands right now is that it's going to be watered down from that, obviously. So now there will be a committee that will be looking at the budget, but it won't have this up or down authority, apparently.
The committee is simply to look into how to reduce federal spending, and of course, concentrating on things other than defense, other than benefits to Wall Street, which may be scaled back. Maybe the great amount has been done, and I don't know if nothing would be more done going forward. But the big handouts have been made, and they're behind us. And I think even the Federal Reserve is concerned that at some point they need an exit strategy, and the longer they let this shell game go on, the harder it'll be. So we had, what would you say, the first shot across the bow with the discount rate hike that I sent an email to Michael Hudson about it, asking, what do you make of this?
Well, the argument on that is that it only affects the banks, and it won't affect real estate. The issue is the interest on the debt. The federal debt went from $8 trillion in 2006 to $12 trillion today, so it's up by 50%. But the interest on the debt is actually less than it was in 2006, and this is because they reduced the interest rate so low, it's almost nothing. So if they added, I read that if they added just one percentage point to the interest rate on the federal debt, it would increase the interest bill for the whole federal debt by $600 billion. And it's already $400 billion. So that would wipe out our entire income tax. I mean, all of our income taxes would be going to pay the interest on this debt.
Am I adding right? That would make it $1 trillion to service the federal debt?
Yeah. Now, we could fix that easily, so easily. Here's what all you have to do is fund your debt through the Federal Reserve. Everybody is shocked that the Federal Reserve is buying up government debt, but that is who should be buying the government debt. And the reason is they rebate all the interest after they deduct their costs. True, they get to pocket their costs. I mean, ideally what you would do is nationalize the Federal Reserve, and then you don't have to worry about interest at all. I mean, you get it all back. Or even eliminate the Federal Reserve and just let the Treasury do it directly. What they should do instead of issuing debt, they should just issue the money. But, of course, that seems like such a radical thing. It's probably not going to happen, but it's not so radical to think of borrowing from the Federal Reserve, which is what they're doing anyway, more and more because they have to, because the Chinese have quit buying. But it's just a matter of perception. I mean, that's what I'm trying to get out there, is this is a good thing. There's no point. We don't need to freak out about this. That's who should be buying our debt. Let's let them.
Helen, the big issue for me on that massive debt that we have to service is not that interest rates are practically nil now. Well, of course, the federal debt includes long as well as short. Short rates are nil. On my money market of funds, I am an expert on it. All I have to do is read my monthly statement to see how nil it is.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, that's the thing. They've cut interest rates way low to save the taxpayers on the federal debt, so they can get away with increasing the debt more and more. But what that means is that savers, people, retired people who have for always counted on making some reasonable, like 5% interest on their money, can't get that anymore. They can't get anything. They can't live on a reasonable, you know, bond interest type investment. So they're forced to speculate in the stock market, which means they're making their money vulnerable to all these speculative ventures up there, and they're bound to lose. I mean, we'll all lose if we're forced to speculate.
Oh, indeed. Rosenberg points out that the public is not speculating in the stock market. They are really, they've been very smart this time, Ellen. They've been taking advantage of rebounds, pulling out stock investments and putting them into bonds. The problem I see with bonds, especially the longer maturities, is that rates may be low now, but given that this absolutely flagrant money creation, sooner or later those rates are going to go up. And
that's the thing. I don't think they will, because the government can't afford to raise the rates, because it'll raise the.
I'm thinking on the long end, which the government has no control over.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth. With financial uncertainty circling the globe due to job losses, decline in the housing market, a climate of corruption, bailouts, currency rigging, and unfair competition, many are once more turning to precious metals as the only hedge against the uncertainty of the future. With the U.S. House conducting hearings on proposals to confiscate workers' personal retirement accounts, including 401ks and IRAs, this is the time to secure your assets. Call Republic Trading Group today, 800-691-7898, before this happens, and find out how easy it is to convert your existing IRA and, in some instances, your 401k plan into real wealth now. Don't let the ravages of hyperinflation caused by the massive increase of fiat currency now flooding world markets affect your retirement account. Call RTG at 800-691-7898 and experience the security and peace of mind that only real gold and silver can offer. That number again is 800-691-7898. Call now.
Here's Dr. John Mattson, a naturopathic doctor, and his views on Cartabite.
I would like to thank you, Don, for making my job so much easier, because your products just make it so simple, right? To fool around with a lot of exotic things that don't work, we can just put them on Cartabite and things start to work almost right away. I've had dozens and dozens of patients with heart problems who have corrected them. And what it's doing, there's so much garlic in there that has a yeast-killing effect. That yeast is a big problem in the gut, pushes the liver hard. It also has metal chelating effect. And most of the other herbs in there, I find that strengthen the arteries. They help to neutralize free radicals. Your remedy is as close to what we do in our program as you can get as far as one supplement goes. It's working on the gut. It's working on the liver. It's working on the arteries. What more can you ask for?
For more information or to order your Cartivite, call 1-877-928-8822. Cartivite is only $69.95 for a 2-month supply of either capsules or tincture. Our website is heartdrop.com.
Attention RBN listeners, the Freeze-Dry Guy, providing the finest in long-term storage food since 1970. Today, the U.S. military and the U.S. submarine service enjoy using these products extensively. In actual scientific tests, these foods typically maintain their high nutritional value in excess of 30 years. These foods are delicious tasting, hearty, light to carry, and easy to prepare under the most adverse conditions. Unfortunately, many people building a family food storage program, as well as many companies providing emergency feeding programs, simply do not give you enough protein, especially animal protein. No other food satisfies like animal protein during stressful times. If you're a meat eater, you will definitely want our freeze-dried meats and entrees, but we do offer vegetarian items as well. Visit freezedryguide.com or call 866-404-FOOD, 866-404-3663. Freeze-Dry Guy, the best you can buy.
Back with Ellen Brown. Ellen, on interest rates rising, for sure not on the short end. I just can't imagine the Fed doing anything with the funds rate. But, of course, that's the only rate it controls. The bond market is another issue. I also get daily emails from the Martin Weiss group. He's a long-time watcher. He puts out some fine stuff. He sent one out this morning that he headlines, this is an attention getter, Armageddon.
Right.
Well, he's thinking of a debt default, but for quite a while he's been harping that it's only a matter of time before these longer rates go up, and when they do, they just may take off. You break through what they call these resistance levels. And, I mean, conditions are so awful, I don't know why they haven't gone up to now. But sooner or later they will. And, that's really when the trouble, I guess, will begin. And, I don't know that he's expecting this to happen, imminently. But, I mean, he's basically saying, it's gonna happen. And, we need to know about it. We need to protect ourselves. Because if we just sit back complacently and have long-term debt, and he's talking about corporate and as well as government and mortgage bonds, Ginny Mae, stuff like that. I mean, he says this stuff is poison. It'll kill you.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think the problem is just the lack of credit, though. If you got credit going again in the States, I think it should start in the States. You could fix all that. You could give nice low interest rates. There's one candidate running for governor in Florida, Dr. Kavari. There are actually four candidates for governor raising this. There's two Democrats, a Republican, and a Green, so it's sort of a nonpartisan issue. And they have different proposals. So Bill Bradbury in Oregon, his proposal is very conservative, and the state bank would basically be a banker's bank, acting sort of like the Federal Reserve for the state, which is pretty much how the North Dakota Bank operates. So he's using the North Dakota Bank as his model. And the other extreme is for Kavari in Florida, he's recommending that the state bank would actually act as a commercial bank. So it would use its money, it would take its assets, maybe pay some interest on it. Like you could pay 4% on your capital base and lend it to homeowners at 2% interest, a very reasonable rate for the homeowners. It would slash their mortgages in half. And you could leverage that by a factor of 9, say. So now you're making 18% on your money, you, the state, less the 4% you're paying for the capital. So you're still making 14% as the state. So it's a very good deal for the state, a very good deal for the homeowners. It will get the housing market going again. And he recommends, rather than having 30-year mortgages at 2%, which would create another housing bubble, what you should do is keep the mortgages, the monthly payments the same, but you would cut the mortgages in half. So you would save the homeowners, like on a $100,000 mortgage, he figures you would save $88,000. So it's a very good deal all around, and it's just a matter of getting the credit machine going again. Now, the objection to that model is that different people, I mean, I have a public banking Google group, and we go around and around on this. We've been going around on this for months, but the question is whether one bank can create 9 times its capital in loans. We know that the whole system does that. I mean, the Federal Reserve itself says that the way the model they have, it's called the multiplier model, where you say create $1,000, or you get in $1,000 deposit, you can lend out $900, and then that $900 will, this is on a 10% reserve requirement, then that $900 will go into another bank, which now has a $900 deposit, so it can lend out $8,100, or in other words, 90% of that. And so over a series of banks, over a series of about 20 transactions, you can turn $100 into $1,000 or $1,000 into $10,000. But the question is whether a single bank could do that. In other words, you get in a $1,000 deposit and then you issue $9,000 worth of loans. Can you do it? But I argue that you can. I mean, Dr. Kavari thinks so, and I would support that, and I'll say why. Because here's how banks do it. First of all, they don't even worry about getting in their deposit. They just make the loan. They make the loan first. So say you make a $1,000 loan. That money goes into another bank. Now you have to cover the bank. Bank A makes a $1,000 loan to their depositor, or their customer. The customer writes a $1,000 check that goes into Bank B. So Bank A has to now attract $1,000 back into the bank, either in the form of deposit or by borrowing it. So that's what I was saying. They can borrow back their own money. So you could, in fact, create a $900 loan on top of a $100 deposit and then just borrow that money back when it leaves the bank. So you can borrow it back short term. And then what you do long term is they issue these CDs, or they attract money from the big institutional investors. They're called, they're highly liquid CDs. So they're not really, you might have a 30-year loan on it, but the investors can turn it over quickly. So anyway, that's how the big banks do it. And so we could do our state bank could do the same thing.
It sounds very logical to me, Ellen. My recollection back in business school was the fractional reserve banking system I learned in my one money and banking courses. Of course, this was back to the 1950s. It taught the system, the banking system, where, you know, money from one bank goes into another, so 1,000 ends up 900, 800, 700, and this is the way fractional reserve banking works, as opposed to explaining that, and they should have, but they didn't, that, well, the system also works the same way, with a single bank, just because of the things that you're explaining very, very briefly now. And, you mentioned that, you'll have a follow-up article to your new one, explaining in more detail exactly how this can work.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be your next article, right?
Yeah. Well, I've got a couple more lined up here, but man, there's so much to write about. I really would love to write a small book on the whole state bank concept and how you would set it up, and different people could contribute to it.
Well, why not? Why not go ahead and do it?
I'm just so busy. I mean, I want to do it. I'm trying. I just you wouldn't believe the amount of time I put on that fourth edition of Web of Dead. I just had to get every little detail right.
Oh, indeed. Yeah. Indeed. I realize that putting out a book, even though you could draw on all of your writing on this topic up to now, maybe that's a way to put together a book. You've got so much written material, and you'll fill in the missing pieces. Then why not? Consider this off in the future. Consider compiling it into a book, and it would be a primer on how to fix this problem. And it really sounds like a very workable system. And when you get down to fundamentals, it's not that complicated. I mean, we certainly have a mess on our hands now. The way we're doing it now is fundamentally broken. I insist corrupted as well as broken, corrupted by design. We seem to have a way to fix this. It certainly can't make things worse than the way they are now. Why not try? You know, we've tried these other methods. Why not try one that may work? I remember a quote by Winston Churchill. Oh, I fundamentally disagree with him, but it's a great quote saying something like, I forget the precise words, but basically, America finally manages to get things right after it exhausts all other possibilities. Something like that. Well, we refuse to get away from those other possibilities that don't work. We keep using them. Well, they don't work. We need another system.
Right. There's another article I would like to write called The Computer Program That Could Have Saved the World from Economic Collapse. I was just interviewed by Max Kaiser.
Yeah.
He actually invented this program. It's the program that Goldman Sachs and Cantor Fitzgerald, who stole this program, basically, are using to manipulate markets. But speaking of the system being broken, the market system is completely broken. There's no such thing as a fair market anymore. They are all manipulated. And so it's just one pump and dump scheme after another. They go in and using this high frequency computer trading program, they go in and front run trades. You know, the market makers are, well, Goldman Sachs and these other firms act as market makers. So when they see the trades coming in, the market maker is supposed to adjust the buys and the sells, match the buys and the sells. So if you have buyers and you don't have sellers, you can sell the stock anyway, guessing at the price, and then you wait for the buyers, which I think right there is a problem. I don't understand why. I know I'm talking too fast here, but I think I'm skipping over some important stuff, but anyway, I don't understand why the stock market has to be so liquid. I mean, why is it that you're entitled to sell your stock even if there's no buyer out there? If you have a lawnmower to sell, or you know, you want to buy a lawnmower and Sears doesn't have any lawnmowers, you just have to wait till the lawnmowers come in. You don't get to walk off with one anyway. Why is the stock market so different that they have to have this middleman in there who is buying and selling stock that doesn't exist and guessing at the price and hoping to make a little spread, you know, to make some money off of when the buyer does come in or the seller does come in, if you understand what I'm talking about.
Roughly. not just the stock market, Ellen. All the markets, commodities, currencies, fixed income, they are all manipulated. You wrote about it in Web of Debt. And I've written about it a few times. I mean, it is outrageous, and that manipulation certainly is a big factor in this big rally that we've had. That whether it's over or not, we'll find out at some point. Possibly, I imagine for sure we've seen most of it behind us. It's possible that it's over. Rosenberg suggests that he's talking about a topping out process. And he goes back to past times where the same thing happens. You reach a peak, and then it just kind of bobs and weaves for a number of months before it does whatever it's going to do. And in the times that he cited, I mean, they always went down after that, picking important years, the last important one, 2007. 2001.
But I wonder if they can manipulate the market so much now. I wonder if they can just keep it going.
Well, at some point they want to bring it down because they make money when it goes up, and they make money when it goes down.
Right, something up. Yeah.
You just have to be on the right side of the bet. So, I mean, they sent it crashing in 2008, especially when September, October, when all hell broke loose. Well, you can bet you that they were on the short side, and they made a fortune. So, I mean, and you remember hearing that Goldman, I forget the time frame, but for a month or for 2 months, they had winning days every single day but one. I mean that's a virtual statistical impossibility.
Right.
Pretty
yeah.
close. One losing day in 30 or 60 days, and they made more money than they've ever made before.
Right.
Well, you know, I mean, if we could front run the markets, you and I, we could buy one of the major networks and take this program into prime time.
Right.
until they kill us, Ellen, because they don't want this kind of information getting out.
Yeah. Well, so Max Kaiser's program was designed to prevent all that. It would have been a computer program that eliminated the market maker. In other words, it would be computerized market making, so it really would have matched buys and sells according to, you know, the number of buys and sells. So it would have come up with a fair price automatically. But what happened was he invented this program, then Cantor Fitzgerald bought it from his firm voted over his objection to sell. I guess I don't know if the whole firm was sold or if that portion of the firm was sold. But anyway, somehow Cantor Fitzgerald bought it, and the shareholders got nothing out of this deal. So it's actually fraudulent. I mean, I think they could bring a lawsuit and maybe get it back. But then, of course, what Cantor Fitzgerald did was bury the program. They don't want that program out there, and then they used it as a base to they have their spin-off programs that allow them to manipulate the market. But had they not had that original program, they wouldn't have known how to do it.
Oh, exactly, Ellen. The same idea is maybe the auto companies buying up a patent or something for an electric car that will jeopardize their business, or the energy companies killing alternative energy methods that are vastly superior to the fossil fuel ones that make them billions of dollars. They just buy up this stuff and they bury it. Same idea with this. Imagine the honeypot for these companies on Wall Street, Ellen. I mean they have this foolproof system. It's like getting tomorrow, almost like getting tomorrow morning's newspaper today. So you know what's going to happen, and we could all get very rich if we had tomorrow's newspaper 24 hours in advance.
Mm-hmm. Or imagine if we actually had a political party that won. I mean, we can fix all this stuff. All we do is get that program back, put it in there, and we could have a fair market again.
In other words, if we had an honest government instead of the corrupted one we now have.
Right. A government could step in and say, we're going to regulate this stuff, and we're not going to allow that your high-frequency or we're going to use this program, which will automatically set the prices, and then you can't front run.
You know, that's the one thing that scares me about gold. Gold seems to me about the only safe investment around, and actually physical gold, and at the same time the gold market can be manipulated like any other one. So if they want to take that market down substantially, at least over a shorter or intermediate period, they can sure do it. And the price of gold for a lot of months was suppressed
last year. It's been suppressed for years.
Oh, I guess for
been
years,
heavily
yeah.
manipulated for years. But the only thing about that is that as soon as the price starts to drop, the Chinese jump in and buy some more. And so there's not much they can do about that. They can't manipulate the Chinese.
Well, I kind of hope they'll take it down substantially over a short period of time. That would be a wonderful entry to jump back in and just hold it, because maybe 5 years from now, whatever you buy will be worth a lot more than you pay for it. Another break, Ellen. A final segment. We'll come back with some more gems from you. Be right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
segment with Ellen Brown. Ellen, one more comment on North Dakota. You mentioned that their prosperity is not an oil issue. It's also not a size issue. North Dakota's population is tiny, about 650,000. Well, because the population is that small, their assets commensurately small, although more because they're prosperous than if they were in the tank. California's population, about 38 million, they have a lot more assets, so they commensurately could put a lot more assets into a state bank and be just as prosperous as North Dakota, except they're not doing it.
Mm-hmm. That's another article that I'm working on, is where will you get the capital base for this bank? I think you can use that investment pool. That California can't touch its investment pool for, you know, those comprehensive annual financial reports that CAFRAs, Walter Burian's been writing about it for like a decade and saying it's a huge conspiracy and that the government has all this money stacked away and they're not using it. Well, I don't think it's a conspiracy. I think it's just bureaucratic inefficiency. That what they've done is every year when some fund has more money than it needs, like let's say the voters vote a bond issue for highways, and they don't use all that money, well, they don't give it back. They should give it back, really. The voters would normally think that if they overpaid on something, that the money would go into next year's budget. But that's not what happens. They stack it away in a highway fund. So now that money is called highway fund money. I saw that there was a lawsuit in San Diego where Governor Schwarzenegger was trying to get some of the highway fund money for the budget. And the judge said, no, that money was, the voters had earmarked that for highways, and that has to go into the highway fund. So there's that money sitting there. The treasurer, this California state treasurer, is managing an investment pool of $62 billion, last time I looked. And this consists of all these monies from various funds, and the treasurer is managing it, like in largely mostly on Wall Street, you know, investing it in Wall Street banks. So that's the money that they can't use for the budget, but he's just managing it for the funds that, or it includes pension funds, of course, and county money, et cetera. He's managing it for them, but they have the say over what it's used for. So what they could do is take that same money, leave it in the Wall Street banks where it is, invest it if you want, whatever, just so you don't shake the boat too much, but designate that those particular investments are now the capital base for your bank. And then you can leverage it. So you could take, let's say you took $10 billion out of that $62 billion and you invested it as equity in your new state bank. Now you can make $100 billion in loans, or even more than that, assuming that's your 8% capital base. So that $100 billion in loans would be plenty to get to solve the credit problems of the state, you know, to get a lot of things going that would put people back to work, generate more taxes, et cetera, just get the whole system working again. And you haven't even touched the investments. I mean, it's not that you're not going to spend that investment money. That's just your equity.
Ellen, we're out of time. When I lived in California briefly in the late 1960s, the state was known as the land of milk and honey. I mean, it really wasn't, but it was lovely to think that way. Mm-hmm. It might become the land of milk and honey again if we only did some of the things that you're recommending.
Yeah. I went to college for $6,000 undergraduate, including a trip to Europe, and that was room, board, and tuition. Tuition at Berkeley was free.
Amazing. The good old days. We're out of time. Ellen, my great thanks. I look forward to the next installment.
You're great talking to you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Ellen. Join us again tomorrow. We're out of time. Ernie Hancock up next. So many issues, so few of us. We'll continue beating the drum on them. You can be sure of that.